I don't fear if from your cradle you depart.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On April 7, 2018, an alleged chemical weapon attack in the city of Douma, Syria, killed at least 50 people. The suspected chemical attack involved two chlorine cylinders dropped from a Syrian Air Force helicopter. Following the incident, the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations said that the symptoms of the casualties were consistent with exposure to a nerve agent. Almost a week later, the United States accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons containing chlorine and the nerve agent sarin to bombard Douma. Syrian President Bashar Assad accused the US, UK and France of staging the attack in Douma, saying the attack did not take place. He called the whole incident a lie and called on the Western governments to provide evidence for the accusations. Also, after a group of Russian specialists tested Douma's soil samples, Moscow confirmed that the results showed no presence of substances containing chlorine or any sort of nerve agents in Douma. Russia also confirmed that Douma's hospitals had not received any patients with symptoms of exposure to sarin or chlorine. On April 14th, hours before the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons fact-finding mission team arrived in Damascus, the US, UK and France conducted missile strikes against the Syrian government. Former US President Donald Trump claimed Washington seeks to establish a deterrent against the production, spread and use of chemical weapons. However, the Syrian Foreign Ministry denounced the attacks as barbaric aggression. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Assad. Western governments, the US in particular, have used different ways from proxies and direct involvement to crippling economic sanctions to oust the Syrian government, yet they have failed. Now, the BBC has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in Syria contains serious inaccuracies. The BBC says it had no evidence to back up a claim that a former chemical weapons inspector, in exchange for money, had expressed doubts over the conclusion that the attack was carried out by Damascus. That could justify the reason why war on Syria has continued for this long.
Well, the war on Syria was always based on lies, on complete fabrications, repeated endlessly. They were from the very beginning an attempt to pull down, totally dismember Syria. They were part of the US and Western allied war in the whole region, also against Iraq, the continuing threats on Iran, the destruction of Libya. So Syria was very much a part of this. And the fact that they've absolutely failed in this effort, now, like, you know, a can of worms, the truth begins to sort of ooze out because they're not willing to continue the war. They see what the U.S. complete defeat in Afghanistan led to. So I think that's why the exposés now. But this was always a lie, and from the beginning, it was very thoroughly debunked.
UK's national broadcaster, the BBC, has admitted that its documentary on an alleged 2018 chemical weapon attack in Syrian city of Douma contained serious inaccuracies. The program reported that a former inspector with the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog had expressed doubts over the organization's stance on the incident. The watchdog, in its probe into the incident, had blamed it on the Syrian government, a charge Damascus denied. The BBC program claimed the inspector was motivated to go public about his doubts in return for getting financial reward from the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks. Now, the British Broadcasting Corporation has accepted that it had no evidence to back up that claim. Also, WikiLeaks has said such a reward was never paid.
The excuse of chemical weapons was used in Syria again and again. In 2012, 2013, it was used for the sanctions on Syria. It was used for the U.S. beginning military actions. The latest exposé in Douma in 2018 was at a time when every report said Syria was clearly winning the war, and that was why this massive new level of bombardment, happened. They just found a new story. All of the media used it. Hundreds and hundreds of news articles from every direction screamed about it. And now we find it's just a fabrication.
It's surprisingly rare for the BBC to rule against itself. The recent confession is hailed as a major victory for truth. Next Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center buildings in New York City. The attacks resulted in tragic death of nearly 3,000 people, while thousands more were injured. For 20 years, successive U.S. administrations have refused to release classified documents related to the investigations of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The documents reportedly could expose a potential link between Saudi Arabia and the hijackers, as 15 out of 19 alleged attackers were Saudi nationals. Also, publicly released documents, including by the 9/11 Commission, have detailed numerous Saudi entanglements, but failed to prove government complicity. The Saudi government has routinely denied any connections to the attacks. In recent months, pressure has mounted on the Biden administration as families of the 9/11 victims demand answers in regard to Saudi government's role in the terrorist attacks on the U.S. soil. Last month, nearly 1,800 Americans directly affected by the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center called on U.S. President Joe Biden to skip the 20th anniversary events unless he upholds his pledge to declassify evidence that could link Saudi Arabia to the attack. President Biden is currently facing sharp criticism over his administration's response to the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country after 20 years of war. It seems, in a bid to deflect the criticism and the pressure on his shoulders, Biden finally gave in and signed an executive order which directs the Justice Department and other federal agencies to begin a review of documents and release declassified information over the next 6 months. U.S. officials assert that Al-Qaeda terrorists carried out the 9/11 attacks. However, many experts and independent researchers have questioned the official account. They believe that rogue elements within the U.S. government orchestrated or at least encouraged the 9/11 attacks in order to accelerate the U.S. war machine and advance the Zionist agenda.
I think it is implausible to believe that 19 people, most of whom didn't speak English, most of whom had never been in the United States before, many of whom didn't have a high school education, could have carried out such a complicated task without some support from within the United States.
Bob Graham and others believe that the United States has deliberately shielded the Saudi Arabia by refusing to expose their links to the attacks in order to protect the Washington-Riyadh relationship. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports between 2016 and 2020. Weapons which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Furthermore, U.S. President Joe Biden has previously refused to penalize the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a prior state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign.
Well, I don't know. The Saudis will definitely react. Whether the United States will do anything, I don't know. I think that the implication here is that we would reduce arms sales or something like that. But, you know, there's such pressures on the economy to maintain the arms sales that I think that there will be some comments. There will be efforts by the Progressive Caucus in the Democratic Party to rein in the Saudis. But I think in the end, unless the real leadership in the State Department and the CIA decides that the Saudis are too much of a price to pay, that other than comments, nothing is going to happen.
Washington has been shielding Riyadh for the 9/11 attacks for two decades. What's for sure is that the lucrative alliance with the Saudis and the kingdom's green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
Good afternoon.
Earlier this year, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan as a means to uphold the 2020 deal reached between former President Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. But the withdrawal of American forces from the country meant that all U.S. allies had to follow suit, regardless of whether they intended to do so, as they depended on U.S. logistics and air support, as well as a safe evacuation of their citizens. The developments in recent weeks have reignited the debate about the formation of a European Rapid Response Force.
And I think it's clear that the need for more European defense has never been as much as evident as today after the events in Afghanistan. Sometimes something happens that pushes the history. It creates a breakthrough. And I think that the Afghanistan events of this summer is one of these cases.
The EU has been working on that. It was positioned for us, 4 years ago as, well, Trump is an unreliable ally. See what he's doing. He's driving the Europeans to do this. But as a matter of fact, that project was under construction before Trump.
In an interview earlier this year, German Defense Minister Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer questioned the bloc's strategic autonomy from the United States. Her comments drew fierce criticism from French President Emmanuel Macron, who believes in the bloc's so-called strategic autonomy.
You know, Europe with its colonial history, it's certainly, you know, not good news to find out that they're building a new army of their own again, because that has never meant anything good for the people in the rest of the world. But the fact that there is maybe another challenger being lifted up and presented to Washington, that's, I think, a healthy development.
But the question now is what it will take for the European U.S. allies to turn their ideas into action and seek independence from Washington.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks, mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019. Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then, the administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do. And so it just is a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who was working with.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelan is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Mm-hmm.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال علي عليه السلام إن الله سبحانه جعل الطاعة غنيمة الأكياس عند تفريط العجزة.
Imam Ali said, "When the disabled falls short in performing acts of obedience to Allah, the Glorified, it is a good opportunity given by Allah for the intelligent to perform such acts." Welcome back, dear friends. It's wonderful to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the things which we should all pay attention to, and of course it is considered the pillar of Islam, is the salah, is the prayer, the namaz. These obligatory prayers which a Muslim prays five times a day. These are known as one of the pillars of Islam. It is the pillar of religion, and it is also considered the mi'raj of the mu'min. So the mi'raj meaning an ascension of the believer. So this prayer, dear friends, the obligatory prayers are one of the most, if not the most important thing in Islam. This five times a day where a human being, a Muslim, takes time out to focus on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the exalted. They take time out to be able to focus on Allah, to be able to pay attention to Allah. They take time out in order to focus their heart and their soul and their body as well towards their Creator, their loving nourisher, Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so we find that these are just the obligatory prayers. I mean, if we speak in layman's terms, this is something that we have to do anyways. We should be doing, right? But Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that he never abandoned even the recommended night prayers, right? These namaz-e-shab, as it's called in Farsi or in Urdu, these are midnight prayers, which of course are recommended. They are not wajib, they're not obligatory, but they are highly, highly recommended for a Muslim, for a believer to pray. So these recommended night prayers were never abandoned by Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, to the extent where not just in the easy and comfortable nights were they not missed by Imam Ali, but even during the most difficult and the most troublesome and the most frightening and horrible of nights, these recommended night prayers were not abandoned by Imam Ali.
For example, it is said that during the Battle of Siffin, which was a very big and all-encompassing battle, the battle against Muawiyah, who had risen up against Imam Ali alayhi salam when he was the caliph of the Muslims, and he was the popularly appointed caliph of the Muslims. Muawiyah rose up and fought and rebelled against Imam Ali. And so one of these nights is called Laylat al-Harir. And in this Laylat al-Harir, in this night, it is said that in some places it is recorded that several hundreds of people were killed in this battle, if not in the thousands. So in this great battle where thousands of people are dying, fighting one another, we find that even on this night, Imam Ali did not abandon his recommended night prayers. And so as a final thought, we also see that Lady Zainab, in the most difficult of times, whether it was Ashura or after that, she too, being the daughter of Ali, did not abandon the recommended night prayers. A profound lesson: keep up your prayers, and even the recommended ones. Brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, my first and foremost advice to you is to fear Allah. Be His obedient servant. Keep His thought always fresh in your mind. Be attached to and carefully guard the principles of Islam which connect you with Him. Can any other connection be stronger, more durable, and more lasting than this? To command greater respect and consideration, or to replace it. Accept good exhortations and refresh your mind with them. Adopt piety and kill your inordinate desires with its help. Build your character with the help of true faith in religion and Allah. Subjugate your nature with the vision of death. Make it see the mortality of life and of all that it holds dear. Force it to realize the actuality of misfortunes and adversities, the changes of circumstances and times, and compel it to study the lives of past people. Persuade it to see the ruined cities, the dilapidated palaces, decaying signs and relics of fallen empires of past nations. Then, meditate over the activities of those people, what they have all done when they were alive and were in power, what they achieved, from where they started their careers, where, when, and how they were brought to an end, where they are now, and what they actually gained out of life, and what was their contributions to the human welfare.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytani al-ayn ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. And I would like to begin with this very question about Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the question about who is Ali is actually a very simple question. What I want to answer tonight is the question of what is Ali? There is a difference between who is Ali and what is Ali. I'll begin with the ayat that I recited from Surah Al-Fatir, Surah number 35. Where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, ayat number 30 and 31, begins by saying that He is the one who revealed to you, O Muhammad, the book, which is actually the book based on Haqq. And this is a book which confirms what it was revealed before it in Torah or Injil or Dawood or other suhuf. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the following ayah, ثُمَّ أَوْرَسْنَا الْكِتَابِ لِلَّذِينَ اسْتَفَيْنَا مِنْ عِبَادِنَا. And then we made heirs to the book some chosen ones from our servants. So Allah says, after you, O Muhammad, we have chosen certain individuals, and they will be the waris of the Quran. They will be the heirs to the book. There is a long discussion about it, especially the words which have come after that first sentence of the second ayat that I recited. But the answer is very simple. There have been debates with the Muslims during the days of the fourth Imam, the days of the eighth Imam on this ayat. And they have conclusively proven that this doesn't apply to the Ummah collectively. It applies to Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. He is the waris of the Quran. He is the heir of the Quran.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Zionist regime officers wounded the detainees, terrorized them, and whomever dared to lift his head upwards risked more beatings by officers. According to affidavits, the floor of the room was covered in blood from the beatings. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Boxbaum Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Palestinian Protesters Recount Harrowing Details of Torture at the Hands of Israeli Regime Police. In May, the world watched the Zionist regime's brutal occupation on full display. The forcible displacement of Sheikh Jarrah residents was underway. The Zionist regime's security forces attacked Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan. The Israeli regime rocket fire rained down on Gaza, and Jewish extremists chanted "Death to Arabs" in the streets. According to multiple testimonies, the Zionist regime police in Nazareth ran a torture room where they ruthlessly attacked Palestinian detainees during the wave of demonstrations against the Zionist regime in May. Now, as international headlines fade on Palestine, the Israeli regime violence continues. Faiz Zobedat was talking on the phone about 20 feet away from a protest in Nazareth. The moment the 21-year-old student hung up the phone, the Israeli regime police threw a stun grenade into the street. An officer then charged at him and punched him in the nose. Zobedat was soon encircled by police who grabbed him, hit him, and pushed him toward a border police officer who tried to slam his head against a wall. "I asked why they were hitting me when I am not resisting," Zobedat said, adding, "I put my hands behind my back even though they didn't handcuff me. Nevertheless, the same border police officer hit me in the nose with the walkie-talkie that he was holding." The officers dragged Zobedat by his head to the police station, beating him along the way. "On the way, we met a policeman who appeared to be an officer and started laughing and said to them, 'Did you only arrest him? That's not enough. We need more,'" Zobedat said. The beating continued inside the police station. Cops kicked, slapped, and hit detainees with batons, laughing as they struck them. Zobedat detailed how one officer smacked detainees with an M16 rifle. He watched as one man with a broken nose, face covered in blood, was continuously hit by officers. Then Zobedat described his own treatment. "A police officer approached me and whispered in my ear, threatening me. He cursed my mother, my sister, and my wife. He then asked, 'Did you understand?' I didn't answer, and he immediately slapped me in the face. He asked me again, 'Do you understand?' I still didn't answer, and he slapped me again in the face. Finally, he said, 'Go explain to your friends.' He pushed me back down to the floor and hit me again." Zobedat's violent detention in May is one of many such, according to Adala, the legal center for Arab minority rights in the occupied territories. The advocacy group collected multiple sworn affidavits attesting to the abuse of Palestinian protesters by the Zionist regime officers, attorneys, bystanders, and children inside Nazareth police station from May 9th to May 14th. The majority of the violent arrests and most of the abuse were conducted by the Zionist regime special forces, including undercover Mistavarim, counter-terror units within the Israeli regime army border police and the Zionist regime police officers pretending to be Palestinians. Adala submitted a complaint to the Zionist regime attorney general and the chairman of the police investigation department on June 7th. In their letter, Adala wrote, "Police officers led the detainees to a room located on the left side of the entrance corridor to the station, forcing them to sit on the floor handcuffed, to lower their heads towards the floor, and began to beat them on all parts of their bodies, using kicks and clubs, slamming their heads against walls or doors and more. Officers wounded the detainees, terrorized them, and whomever dared to lift his head upwards risked more by beatings by officers. According to the affidavits, the floor of the room was covered in blood from the beatings. Under the Zionist regime law, authorities must respond to the letter within 45 days. By Adala, attorney and co-author of the complaint, Wassam Sharaf, who told Mint Press that Adala has not received a response from the Attorney General or Police Investigation Department. Adala did receive a response from Nazareth, Chief of Police, stating that he will cooperate if there is an investigation and will take the appropriate disciplinary actions. What happened inside the police station in Nazareth amounts to torture and ill-treatment and requires the immediate opening of a criminal investigation to examine the circumstances and the conditions of the protesters' detention at the station, including the investigation and prosecution of police officers involved in the violence," Adala attorneys wrote in their complaint. Sharaf explained that the witness and victim accounts of police brutality inside the Israeli regime police station describe activity deemed torturous under international law. "What we have seen in the police station is that instead of investigating the people, the police would beat them up. The police deny the detainees in need of medical attention. That medical attention make them sign false affidavits as a condition to get medical attention. When this treatment is directed at detainees, it may amount to torture according to international law. Torture is defined under international law as intentionally inflicting severe pain or suffering in order to obtain a confession or information, intimidate or coerce the individual, or as punishment for alleged offenses. Torture is illegal and considered a war crime." In a statement to Mint Press News, the Zionist regime police said, "We emphasize that an investigation branch officer contacted the director of detention on behalf of the public defender's office and requested the presence of defense attorneys at the station. And accordingly, when the detainees arrived at the station, two defense attorneys were present to advise them. Unfortunately, some of the lawyers complaining about the appeal were at the entrance to the station, tried to create provocations on the spot. Notwithstanding the foregoing, they were periodically allowed to enter the station and tour the facility in order to prove that the detainees were being treated properly." The police spokesperson also noted that medical staff was present at the station and detainees in need of medical care were promptly treated. The Zionist regime police launched a mass arrest campaign in May, targeting Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories who participated in protests against ethnic cleansing in Sheikh Jarrah, attacks at Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza. The Israeli regime police arrested 2,142 individuals and filed 184 indictments during Operation Guardian of the Walls and Operation Law and Order. According to Sharaf, more than 150 Palestinians were arrested in Nazareth in May, and about 1 in 10 were indicted. Ashraf Mahroum, an attorney representing 9 people detained by police in Nazareth, said his clients and others were charged for protesting illegally, creating illegal organizations, and assaulting police officers. Mahroum's clients allege police fired rubber bullets at the upper parts of their bodies during the protest, a direct violation of the law governing use of rubber bullets. During their detention, officers struck them with batons and smacked them over the head with guns. Most of his clients' injuries were on the head and face. Some were forced to sign affidavits stating they won't disclose what happened to them in order to receive medical treatments. Evidence of similar police violence against Palestinians appeared in other cities across 1948 occupied Palestine, including in Lydd, Acca, Jaffa, and Haifa. Sharaf said, adding detainees in those localities arrived in court with visible signs of abuse. Sharaf concluded, Adala has other testimonies about police brutality in different areas. Some of this brutality was against protesters and some of it has been inside police stations against detainees. With the systematic ill-treatment that we have witnessed from May 9th to May 14th, we can assume that more people have been subject to such kind of treatment. The Zionist regime security agency, ISA, has long used torture as a standard tactic during interrogations of Palestinian residents of occupied territories. Until late 1990s, the ISA was allowed to use psychological pressure and a moderate degree of physical pressure in order to prevent terrorism, according to 1987 recommendations from a state commission. The Commission's opinion permitted the ISA to use methods of torture in their interrogations under the Necessary Defense Clause found in the Israeli regime penal law. The Israeli regime Supreme Court banned the use of physical methods during interrogations in 1999 after a series of petitions were filed by human rights organizations and Palestinians who experienced ISA interrogations. However, the court ruled the practice of physical pressure could remain in urgent cases as part of the ticking bomb exception under the necessity defense. This legal loophole has allowed torture and ill-treatment to persist in ISA interrogations, despite the Zionist regime Justice Ministry having drafted a law to criminalize torture. According to Public Committee Against Torture in the Occupied Territories, PCATI, 1,300 complaints regarding the use of torture against Palestinian citizens in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, OPT, by the ISA have been submitted to the Ministry of Justice since 2001. These complaints resulted in only one criminal investigation and no indictments. PCATI receives dozens of complaints each year, attesting to brutality occurring during arrest, detention, interrogation, and imprisonment of Palestinians from OPT. The nonprofit organization estimates 5% to 10% of these cases amount to instances of severe torture. Severe interrogations increased sharply in 2020. In the passing year, more people were tortured in the occupied territories than in any other year in the past decade, PCATI said in their 2020 situation report on torture of Palestinians by the Israeli regime security forces. While cases of torture are prevalent within OPET, Tal Steiner, Director General of PCATI, said 1948 occupied Palestine is now experiencing an escalation of torture incidents. Steiner told Mint Press PCATI has seen attributes that are usually found in the West Bank trickling into the occupied territories. There is administrative arrest, prevention of rights to seek counsel, to receive medical attention. Those are things that are quite unfortunately common in the West Bank and the occupied territories that have now become more evident within the occupied territories proper. This is not something that's usual or routine within the occupied territories for the citizens, Palestinian or not. so it's a turn for the worse. Steiner attributed this surge within historic Palestine to a culture of impunity spurred by the Zionist regime politicians like former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, explaining, when the police and military forces entered the mixed cities within the occupied territories to so-called restore the peace, then Prime Minister Netanyahu was quoted saying, go ahead and do your job and don't worry about any commission of inquiry. These types of announcements by the Prime Minister and other Israeli regime leaders can also be a reason why police officers thought they could get away with it. They can use extreme force towards citizens, demonstrators, and especially toward people from minority groups and go unpunished. On May 13th, the eve of Muslim holiday Eid al-Fitr, Nazareth resident Omar Laban was out with friends to celebrate. As he approached an ATM to withdraw money, he saw an officer decked in full riot gear running toward him. Instinctively, he began running away. The cops started throwing grenades at me, and I kept running because I knew that if I stood still, I could be badly wounded by the grenades. Laban said, while I was still running, one of the policemen raised his hand and hit me in the left eye, and I fell to the ground. Police surrounded Laban on the pavement, kicking him in the face and head. One officer pressed his boot into Laban's head and shoulder. I felt intense pain all over my body from my head to my legs. One of them started kicking me in the artery behind the ear, Laban said. At that moment, I thought I was going to die. At the police station, Laban saw detainees stuffed into a room resembling prisoners of war. They sat on the floor with their legs folded under them and heads bent. A masked officer paced around the room with a club-like object in his hand. Any detainee who lifted his head met the full swing of the officer's bat on their head. They pushed me down in the corner, and I lowered my head and curled up. Nevertheless, the same police officer hit me hard on the head with that object, Laban said. Days after his detention, Laban still felt excruciating pain throughout his body. He couldn't sleep from the dizziness. He couldn't eat without vomiting. He couldn't speak coherently. He still doesn't understand why he was arrested when he wasn't participating in any nearby protest. It was the first time I had been arrested, an arrest that I believe was illegal, pointless, and very violent, Laban said.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the evil of interest. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Brothers and sisters, Islam forbids lending and borrowing of money on interest. We know this rule, which also entails certain limits on commerce. It is ironic that this country's intellectuals tend to look with favor on communism, for instance, and yet are inclined to support an economic order based on interest. The fact of the matter is that interest has been the most important cause of economic and financial catastrophes in the world. Now, the question we want to raise is, are we living a life that is free of interest money? Being a Muslim, being a follower of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, it's a very critical question. If we are part of the problem, we're not going to be able to solve the problem. So why is it that the whole world, even the communist world, which theoretically don't really believe in the interest-based system, right, unlike capitalism, why is it that they even are drowned in this interest-based economic system? Interest is one of the most destructive economic forces in the world and a major hurdle that stops the poor from moving forward. It is thus imperative that mankind rid itself of interest. It would also prevent the accumulation of wealth into the hands of a few people, which is extremely dangerous and detrimental for overall economic progress. Now, what do we do about it is secondary. The first and the primary thing is to identify the problem. It is the interest-based economic models. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the evil of interest. And we said that, unfortunately, our lives, one way or the other, are indulged and connected to interest-based economic models. And these interest-based economic models are the evil and the problem and the root cause of many problems and issues we see in the society. Interest enables a shrewd and clever businessman to accumulate vast amounts of money, which then enables him to control markets or establish large factories, thereby reducing many people to perpetual economic subservience. If one were to examine the list of the world's richest men, it would be found that it was made up of mostly people who owe their rise to interest. They start with a small amount of capital, but soon establish a reputation of creditworthiness, which allows them to leverage their small personal capital many times over via bank borrowing and overdrafts, thereby becoming super rich in just a few years. How many examples are right in front of our eyes? There are others who may not have any significant amount of invest, but use their wit and contacts to cultivate relationship with bank managers to borrow large sums of money. Only a tiny percentage of the rich make their entire money from personal capital. Rest of it is all